Dave, I've got a question for you. When I say the words portable, powerful, and professional, what does it make you think of?
It makes me think of Brad Geiger in a suit, but it also makes me think of the Wacom One from the good folks at WACOM.com, Wacom, which we use in our studios. Am I right, friend? Did I guess right?
Absolutely. You guessed exactly right. Our sponsors for Comic Lab, once again, Wacom. And we're thrilled to welcome them back as a sponsor because, as you've pointed out, we both use those in our studios day in and day out. And they are indeed powerful, portable, and most of all, professional tablets that we can count on.
It is a match made in heaven to have them as sponsors of the show because this is a product without ever having met the folks from Wacom before, that we have used for the better part of 10, 15 years in our own studios. So it is like asking a duck if they would recommend water. We love Wacom. We use them on a daily basis in our own studios. And so having them as sponsors is a perfect match, and we are so happy to welcome them aboard. So do go check them out over at WACOM.com and check out that Wacom One while you're there because it is a fantastically powerful, portable, perfect device for your on-the-go cartooning.
Precisely. So, Dave, did you know that there's dinosaur teeth on the moon?
I can safely say that I did not know that there were dinosaur teeth on the moon. I don't know if I'm being pranked. What is happening?
Supposedly, there are. Yesterday,
astronauts bringing dinosaur teeth? What?
Well, hold on. I'm going to tell you all about it.
All right.
Yesterday, my son Alex graduated from high school, so we took them out.
Hey, first of all, we can't let that go. That's a big deal as a parent.
Oh yeah.
Soon to be an empty nester. Oh my goodness. Oh.
Yeah. I've got about 3 or 4 years because I've got my younger son Max is going to be a sophomore in high school this fall. So I've got about 3 or 4 years before I've got to deal with empty nest syndrome.
And then you can go back to being 24-year-old Brad and pat around the house naked. That's what you can go back to. That's what empty nesting is.
That's right. Which I'm very much looking forward to.
But your neighbors are not, but keep going. Okay.
No. The neighbors are having those reinforced blinds put in.
You're getting the double, like, super blackout blinds installed.
Yeah,
the ones that, like, no light
blinds
is allowed in. Yeah.
So last night, while we took them out to Red Lobster, that was going to be the go-to place. And by the way, none of us has gone to a restaurant. This was the first time,
Did you go inside?
First time, we went inside.
I'm still not there emotionally. Godspeed, my friend. I am not there emotionally.
Yeah. You know what? After a little bit, I felt a little bit nervous, but after my after I had a glass of wine, everything was okay. Then it was starting to even
half
out.
A glass of wine later, Brad's like, what does it mean to die at the end of the day? What matters that to do?
But as we were waiting for the food to come, my son turns to me and he says, you know that there are dinosaur teeth probably on the sun, on the moon. And I go, what do you mean? And they say, now listen, I was reading this online and it's fascinating. The asteroid that came to Earth to wipe out the dinosaurs was so big and so fast that it vaporized the atmosphere and created a vacuum on the planet, which sucked a bunch of dinosaur pieces out into orbit.
No, the timeline is wrong. That can't be right. The moon was formed like 4 or 5 billion years ago. That can't be right.
Really?
Yeah, the dinosaurs only existed for many hundreds of millions of years, but. No,
wait,
that can't be right.
Are you saying the dinosaurs didn't have a moon?
No, the dinosaurs had a moon. The moon formed like, I don't remember the exact number, but it was like 4 or 5 billion years ago the moon formed.
Yeah. I'm not saying this event created the moon. The moon was already there. I'm saying that this asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs splatted a bunch of dinosaur pieces.
Oh,
out into
I understand.
Orbit.
You're saying the one that hit in the Mexican Peninsula,
yeah,
potentially wiped out the dinosaurs, created enough of an upthrow that it got into the lunar orbit. That's what you're saying. I thought you were saying when the moon was formed, dinosaurs were walking around and they're like, well, here we go.
No. It basically, the impact threw dinosaur parts so high because it also created a vacuum. Here, I'll read it right off of this.
That sounds at least a tiny bit plausible. I genuinely thought you were saying the dinosaurs were around when the moon was formed. Okay.
No.
When the asteroid hit, it created such an updraft of material that dinosaurs were sucked up into it.
Right. This is from The Ends of the World by Peter Brannon. The meteorite itself was so massive that it didn't notice any atmosphere whatsoever. It was traveling 20 to 40 kilometers per second, 10 kilometers, probably 14 kilometers wide, pushing the atmosphere and building such incredible pressure that the ocean in front of it just went away. These numbers are precise without usefully conveying the scale of the calamity. What they mean is a rock larger than Mount Everest hit the planet Earth traveling 20 times faster than a bullet. This is so fast that it would have traversed the distance from the cruising altitude of a 747 to the ground in 0.3 seconds. Oh. All right. So in its nearly instantaneous descent, it compressed the air below it so violently that it briefly became several times hotter than the sun. So all of this means as the asteroid collided with the Earth in the sky above it, where there should have been air, the rock had punched a hole of outer space vacuum into the atmosphere. As the heavens rushed in to close this hole, enormous volumes of Earth were expelled into orbit and beyond all within seconds of impact. So there's probably little bits of dinosaur bone up on the moon. Throw that in with the fact that teeth are often some of the most often found fossils because they're so rugged. And there's no erosion on the moon. There's no bacteria. So anything that's up there is in pristine condition.
I have enough both science knowledge and science ignorance that this could absolutely be pulled over on me, that this might have been a possibility, that the vacuum was strong enough to suck up surface stuff. But imagine, let's just pretend for a second that this is the case, that there was imagine being the poor son of a bitch stegosaur that's like, oh shit, here I go! I'm doing it! I'm going to the moon! Oh god! Just enough lungs, oxygen in your lungs, you're aware of the fact that you were leaving the surface of North America and headed to the moon. Oh, here I go!
It makes that whole Ralph Cramden bit take on a whole different aspect, right? Bang, zoom, to the moon, Alice. These dinosaurs literally got punched to the moon. And there are pieces of them, says the scientist, to be found up there.
Well, now, aside from the massive, massive amounts of UV radiation that they would be hit with on the surface, there's no natural decaying features on the moon in the sense of an oxygen or bacteria or, you know, any of the normal things that would, for the same reason why certain bits of newspaper from the Titanic survived at the super cold distance at the bottom of the ocean, moon being somewhat sterile enough that's a weird topic. What a weird cold open. I did not expect to talk about dinosaur teeth today.
When my son mentioned this to me, I was fascinated with it. I mean, I'm ready to get behind the idea of sending like a Mars rover up there just to sift through the dirt and find what might be embedded up there.
Well, speaking of sending things to the moon, did you see Jeff Bezos has decided to go on his first rocket, first manned rocket that he's got?
Yes.
Now, I don't know about you, but when I think of the word hubris, I think of you've built yourself up to be the richest human in all of history, and then you decide to go on the first manned rocket from your company. Not the third, not the 10th, but you're like, nope, the first one is the one for me. I just feel like this is the last chapter of a book, potentially. It's like, and then he died. That just feels like that's how that could end up really easily.
Listen, for his sake, let's hope that that Amazon software is not running that thing. Because you and I have both tried to set up Amazon servers. We've had experience with software. For his sake, let's hope that it's not Amazon software.
We're not going to get a better blow than making fun of Amazon's back-end software. So I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Club, the show ostensibly about dinosaur teeth and making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his pal Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of the comic strip documentary Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. Two quick bits of business we got to get out of the way. One, you can actively be joining us live every week as we record the show over at Comic Lab Live Gab. All we need you to do is join us at patreon.com/comiclab at the $10 level, and you could be watching Brad and I every week. 8:30 a.m. Pacific, 11:30 a.m. Eastern. And we'll also have archives of the show that you can check out as well. And it is a dang delight to see Brad Geiger's mug. Right now I'm looking at it and all sorts of feelings just washing over me, washing over me.
It's like, I get a lot. I get that a lot.
It's like a Roman caldarium and frigidarium. I'm washed over by feelings just looking at Brad Geiger.
See, now, when I read books, the only feelings that wash over somebody is nausea. There's only waves of nausea. There's never waves of good feelings that wave over somebody. It's always nausea.
Well, I think that's why we established that your neighbors are installing blackout curtains. They're preparing for you to be an empty nester. They're preparing.
That's a good point.
And then the other bit of news that I have to share with everyone is that as I do every couple of years, I'm kickstarting a Drive book. And if my calendaring is right, it should be active right now over at drivekickstarter.com. And I hope you go check it out. I'm immensely proud of Drive. I think it is the best thing that I've ever done. And I mean that sincerely. I love the story. I love the characters. I love the settings. I love the ships. And with the drivekickstarter.com, you can get Act 3 right now, or you can get Acts 1, 2, and 3. So I would love it if you guys checked it out. I am immensely, immensely proud of how that story is coming out.
Yeah. And Dave, I've got to ask you now, when you called me just before you were recording that, and you said, hey, do you have any ideas? You've seen a bunch of my videos. And the first thing I told you is that I use all of your Kickstarter videos in my class when I talk about crowdfunding as an example of what to do. Because I think your videos are probably the best Kickstarter videos. I haven't seen anybody that's been able to touch them as far as that goes. You do immensely good Kickstarter videos. But I said one thing that I've been finding on TikTok, and I actually got this from a social media manager that is recording advice on TikTok. She said, if you want your TikTok videos to go and get engagement, you've got to get their attention in the first 30 seconds, which makes perfect sense to me. I knew that, but I had to hear somebody say it. The next video, I rewrote the next video I was working on, and it went like a shot. Just got immediate engagement because I wrote it so that it got attention in the first 30 seconds. So I gave you that advice. I said, Dave, get their attention in the first 30 seconds. My question to you is, how did you do it?
Well, I'll tell you, one thing, the podcast actually informed how I did it. I got off the phone with you, and it's actually nice to be reminded of things that you already know. Like from my own past Kickstarters, I always kind of do second line of the video is a joke. Like, set up establishing line and right into with a joke on the video because you don't have time. Most people are like, what is this bullshit? I get it. They're selling me something. All right. You're either going to back it already or probably not going to back it. And so, you know, within seconds. But for those people, the thin slice of people that are on the fence, like, oh, I like Dave's other stuff or I like Dave. If you can sell them with a joke within the first 10, 15 seconds, you got them. So you will be happy to know, Brad, that you had said, why don't you use your Scottish meditation thing from the podcast? And I had not thought about the Scottish meditation thing. So I actually have a tiny little bit in the video about Scottish meditation for dogs. And I'm just, my dog is, in the video, my dog is trying to nap, and I'm just yelling at him, Ack, no, you wee numpty pup, what are you doing? You know, just screaming at him. And what's great is we pushed in with the camera just as he did a look on a dog's face of like, what is this asshole doing? Like, he just looked up at the camera in a perfect sort of take that you can't plan with a dog. And I was so amazed by it. I was like, oh my God, the timing of that look was perfect. Like, really?
Yeah.
Really? You're going to do this video when I'm trying to sleep? All right. Well, I guess we're doing this.
Well, good. I cannot wait to see it. And by the way, the Ollie checkup this week, how's the young pup doing after his harrowing event?
He's doing good. I continue to be amazed at how hardy a dog is, even a little small 14-pound dog. Like, I mean, there's a reason that evolution did all right with wolves. They're hardier than you think they are. Anyway, so I'll just say this. I rarely push my own stuff on the show, but God, do I love Drive, and am I proud of Drive. So head over to drivekickstarter.com and at least have a look. If nothing else, I think you'll see Beth and I did a lot of planning on this show, especially Brad. We ended up doing the add-ons onto the Kickstarter. For folks that are not familiar with add-ons and you're planning your own Kickstarter, go have a look at how that works. Once you've made a pledge for, you know, whatever book, you'll just see it propagates to another screen that says, hey, you're now pledging. Would you like to add on any one of these four or five things? And it actually, nice. I think it's a good system. So anyway, drivekickstarter.com. I do appreciate your support. And Brad, what is the first topic for this week?
Well, the first topic for this week is awards. We're right in the summer of 2021, and that means a lot of the awards are coming out. The Eisner Awards have released their list of nominees, and we want to send out our congratulations to everyone who was nominated for an award, including someone that I know is a Comic Lab listener. Sean Cleefield got nominated for Best Academic Work. He did an academic book on webcomics.
I think we're mentioned in that book once or twice.
I got to tell you, that was the first, I was telling you this privately, that was the first time I really got taken seriously for comics from my father-in-law, who was very much an academic. And he was familiar.
I just realized what you just did. You said it was the first time I was taken seriously, but then you gestured to your body, and it was like it was the first time that I wasn't just judged based on my looks. That I was considered for my webcomics ability. I wasn't just this piece of ham that everyone wants a slice of.
It wasn't just
you did a body gesture. You're like, I wasn't. Now, I gotta tell you, 3 weeks on TikTok, Brad, it's already having an impact on your psyche.
Put your head on my shoulder. No, he recognized this publisher, Bloomsburg or Bloomsbury Publishing. And he was like, wait a minute, I've got books from these people. This is a real publisher. And I'm like, yeah, not like that dreck that I'm doing, you know, that I self-publish. This is a real publisher. And it was the first time he sat there and started reading it. It was amazing. So, yes, you and I are quoted extensively throughout this book. And probably that's one of the reasons that it was nominated for an Eisner Award.
Oh, my goodness. Listen to you. Well, Brad's quotes helped out. Mine were a detriment to it. But, yeah. Anyway, but Brad, this was also a big week because just catching people up that might not have heard, the Pulitzers also had a bit of an awkward moment for comics in that I don't know that I've ever seen this happen. So just a bit of back history for everyone that's not a journalist. The Pulitzers, as a juried prize, have always historically had a bit of an FU towards comics. They kind of don't love the fact that amongst all the serious journalism, you have editorial cartoons in the mix, right? So that's just a little bit of backstory that you need to know. Anyway, this year, for the first time ever, in what can only be described as the biggest FU in particular to comics, they nominated three people and then decided not to give an award to that category.
Yeah, well, and I'm going to even like course correct a little bit. It's not the first time because remember we talked about this on the show last year. Last year they nominated three people. By the way, there was one person, Lalo Alcaraz, who was nominated both times, who's been stiffed both times. Could you imagine getting nominated twice and having this happen? But so last year they nominated three people. Didn't give the award to any of them, and instead chose the illustrator who does paintings that get used for the cover for the New Yorker.
Yes, Brad Weiser. Yes, they did do that.
And I didn't say it at the time. I don't think we hit this drum real hard at the time. But he's not I don't know.
It's not specifically editorial cartooning. Yeah.
No, it's not editorial cartooning at all. Editorial cartooning is a specific thing. It takes a stance. It has an opinion. These were very good illustrations, but they weren't editorial cartoons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they and this person was not nominated. They turned down all three and gave the award to this person that wasn't even nominated. They moved him into contention. So there was that last year. Now this year, by the way, here's something else you got to realize. It costs money to enter your stuff for the Pulitzer Prize. And ooh, if you win, it comes with a sizable check. In other
words,
it's
journalism.
Not just,
I think we could all agree anything over $5 makes a sizable difference to someone in journalism.
And it's quite a bit more than $5 that you get. It's a good sized check that you get for winning the Pulitzer Prize. So there, you got to take that into account too. This year they had three nominees, including one person that was nominated the year before, and they gave it to none of them. They didn't give anybody a prize in editorial cartooning. And not only that, did you know this, David? They created a new category that hadn't been on the list before, created a brand new category that had no nominees, selected somebody to win in that category, and gave them a moneyed prize.
Well, okay, I will say that the one that they created was very worthy, and it was worthwhile, and it was perfectly acceptable to me that they created that category. But I will say this, because this happens with the Eisner sometimes, where they create categories. That's okay by me, because it allows for a certain flexibility in jury prizes. But the specificity of having three nominees ready to go, all of which are tremendously impactful editorial cartoonists. Lalo's a fellow Los Angelino, and I like him a lot. And so his work is amazingly impactful. And the fact that they were basically like, you know what? Nah, never mind. Nobody. Editorial cartooning, shine that. Nah.
Listen, I'm gonna share my ignorance. I don't know who the new category was.
It was I'll be specific. It was, and bless her heart, it was the poor woman. I think she's a teenager who captured the George Floyd video. They created the category for her, and rightfully so. She changed the course of American history with that one video. So she deserved it, because also her life has been impacted horribly. So that one was a very worthy prize to create for her. But the specificity of having three nominees ready to go, and editorial cartooning again getting the shit. It's such a bummer for me, because I gotta say to the crowd listening, if there's a specific genre of cartooning for which there is very little income at the creation of cartoons and no income on the back end of the creation of cartoons. Like, there's no lingering, like, long tail income as that cartoon goes forward in its life. It's editorial cartooning. You're doing it in part because you're a believer in your cause, and you're trying to change the world, and you're trying to impact the world. And so kind of one of the things they have left is the Pulitzer. Like, I'm still going for that brass ring. I could still win a Pulitzer. Yeah. And to have the rug pulled out from them, even as a non-editorial cartoonist, I'm like, geez. Jeez, that stings. That is really a gut shot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the American Association of Editorial Cartoonists has gotten involved and has written a very strongly worded letter about this. And basically, they're asking for their entry fees back, because they're like, it's not really fair to take entry fees and then not give anybody an award.
Yeah, it's it really is I know it's such a meme, but it really is a very specific fuck you in particular to editorial cartoonists of like, nope, just you. You guys are on the hook for it. I personally feel tremendously bad for the editorial cartoonists that got nailed this year, because it's like I said, it's not a field that pays a lot, and it's never going to be a field that pays a lot. And in the last 5 to 8 years, like, a quarter of editorial cartoonists have lost their job, at least in North America, in Canada and the U.S. And so it's such a bummer that the one thing they had left is good awards, and they don't get that this year. It's a stinker move. All right, well, Brad, I'm gonna jump us into our question from Jack coming in over patreon.com/comiclab. And Jack writes, Brad and Dave, how do you attract collaborators? Well, I'll tell you what you do. When you're Brad, you walk around the house naked, apparently. That's how you attract collaborators.
I just wear my best plaid shorts and...
plaid shorts.
Your best dad cargo shorts.
Anything that shows off these biceps and just let her rip.
Exactly. All right. How do you attract collaborators? Likewise, what about a project or a creator would entice or interest you in collaborating with them beyond simply making you a fan? This is a great question because I have a very specific answer, but I would love to hear your answer first on how you could be enticed to be to a project, but also more specifically, how you would attract a collaborator.
Yeah, I'm not the best person to ask for this because I don't like collaborating in my own personal work. Like, I like collaborating in somebody else's work. Like, Dave has asked me to do a story for Drive. I'm very excited about that.
And I should mention to the listeners, it's going to be a meet cute in the Drive world because I am notoriously terrible at anything relationship wise in terms of my writing. So Brad is going to write a meet cute for Drive with chef's kiss is just great.
Yeah,
so
we're gonna do romantic comedy for Drive, and I'm very much looking forward to that. But my set, like for my properties, for my things, I'm not looking for collaborators other than my number one collaborator, and that's Alex Heberling, who colors Evil Inc. and the other properties. And she very much brings a whole set of skills to the table. Aside from that, I don't play well with others. I'm very solitary in my creativity. So I'm not a great person to ask because I'm not looking for this. I'm not looking for collaborators at all. I wouldn't even tell you. I guess I could give you some thoughts on how I might go about it. But because the number one thing is I'm seeing the word attract collaborators. And I'm not sure that word attract worries me a little bit. In other words, this isn't like a Blue Jay sitting on a phone line trying to have the best plumage so that other people notice the Blue Jay, right? This is most collaborations are when people it's a mutual thing. Your skills are to the point that I think that this would be a good project. My skills are to the point that maybe I wouldn't hold you back, you know. I don't know that it's about attracting. It's about finding people that work well together. Do you see what I mean, Dave?
I do. I don't have as much of an umbrage with the word attraction. I think there is something. There's an element of the word attraction that's correct in the sense that it is a little bit of form of first date-ism. In the sense mm-hmm. that when you go out on a first date, you're not necessarily, you're trying to present the best version of you on a first date. You're not necessarily lying, but you're just trying to present I'll reveal the problems by date three, you know, that kind of a thing.
Yeah,
you're not immediately going, well, here are my issues, you know, that kind of thing. you're revealing the, but I will say this. For me, on the times where, like Brad, I am not naturally a collaborator. I think all of us who are in cartooning, if we're honest about it, it's a career that sort of self-selects at every stage for people that fly solo and right, like from elementary school and high school and college and after college, it was you drawing by yourself or you writing by yourself off in a corner or you know, I'm going to create these little stories. And some of that is because the crowd might not have been nice to you. And some of it is just because we are self-isolating people. I think I'm the latter. I like alone time, you know, that kind of thing. So I think there's some self-selecting thing in terms of personalities that go on with comics. But when collaborations do happen, for me anyway, I think it usually is because someone is as good, if not more usually better than I am at a specific thing. And so I want to work with them because it's fun to be around someone who is very capable. It's fun to be around someone who is good at a thing. And you like the idea that by working together, you make the final project better because they bring all of XYZ to the table that you don't bring to it. So, for example, with Stripped, with the collaboration with Fred, I had all this wealth of knowledge of comics history and all these contacts in the industry, and I could go out to cartoonists and get the interviews. But at the time that we were starting the film, I didn't know one lens from another. I didn't know lighting. I didn't know sound. I didn't know editing choices, right? All of that at the beginning of the film, I didn't know. Fred brought all this wealth of literally decades of learning about film And I brought decades of learning about comics, and it was sort of like peanut butter and chocolate coming together. You know, it was like this nice little mix of different flavors of skill sets. So for that, it worked out great. And then we learned from each other. He began diving into cartooning much more, and I began to dive into filmmaking and editing and all that sort of stuff much more. All of which is to say, he was better at a thing than I was, and that was attractive to me as a collaboration, right? I wasn't going to go out and hunt someone who's like, who is worse at filmmaking than me? Let's go find that person, right?
Yeah.
So for me, it's they got to be as good, if not better, at the thing than I am for the collaboration to spark. And then I think, honestly, you for me anyway, you can't undercut how important the personal touch is, you know?
Yeah.
It's so much of it has to be based on personality. Like, I think it comes through on the show, but I genuinely love talking to Brad every week. I look forward to it. It enervates me and energizes me. I get ideas and excitement and optimism coming out of talking with Brad, right? So, like, the personal touch is incredibly important for me. So not only do I think Brad is a better podcaster, and I do, I think also he, on a personal level, is someone that I genuinely love to be around, even though he's in Philadelphia and I'm in Los Angeles. Like, I'm a happier person when we get to hang out. And so that it was a huge part of the collaboration for me when you or I first pitched the podcast. I don't remember which one of us did it. But that for me was the kicker, was the personal touch. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, and I got to tell you, I feel the exact same way. The reason that this podcast has been going for 3.5 years is the fact that it's mutual. I look forward to talking comics with you every week. And frankly, I think you're the better podcaster, if you want to be honest.
Look at us. Aren't we a pair?
I searched you out was that I you bring a lot to the table that I wouldn't think about normally. So that may be the hallmark of a really good collaboration, is that there's also mutual respect, right?
Yes.
Everybody brings a certain thing to the table that that is worthwhile.
Right. And what's interesting about that is before contracts were ever signed, and we did sign contracts, before contracts were ever signed for Comic Lab, we had a mutuality, like you said. Like, there was a respect there that I'm not going to step on Brad's toes. Brad's not going to step on my toes. And we trust one another not to do that, right? But as far as being enticed, so we've talked about attracting a collaborator, but I will be honest, the rarer thing for me is being enticed to be a collaborator with a project. And I think that's very much a subjective thing with my personality, in the sense that I want to work for me, by me, with me. I mean, like, my wife is constantly like, you could be a television writer. You'd be a really good television writer. I'm like, I know. I don't want to be in a room with 12 other people pitching jokes for him. I am one part of the wheel. You know, I like being the whole wheel. I like doing it all myself, and I like being alone, frankly. So I don't want to be a TV writer. And I'm sure you've had the same with all sorts of things where it's like, Brad, you would be an excellent XYZ. And you're like, no, I like being alone. I like doing my own thing.
Yeah. That means showing up to a room and dealing with people.
Two
things that I've very much enjoyed not doing in 2020.
You know? I know. I overheard my wife. Someone was like, "So how did you guys do through the pandemic?" And my wife was like, "Oh, it was tough for me. You know, I'm a people person." And then somebody must have said something, because she goes, no, Dave was fine. Turns out he's living a monastic lifestyle quite happily during the pandemic." That's all I overheard on the phone. He's living a monastic lifestyle.
I said the same thing. I said, I went into the pandemic an introvert. I came out a recluse. And frankly, not going any place and not talking to people, that's my top two.
So I think, Jack, to put a button on the thought, I think for both Brad and I, in terms of being attractive to other people for collaboration and then being enticed ourselves to a project, so much of it is someone who is doing their best work, who believes in it, who is really trying to put their best work out there, is very attractive. And I know Brad doesn't like that word, but I like that word, attractive. It is attractive when someone is really putting in the time to produce their best work. And I think there's something attractive about someone whose skill set is very different than yours and complements yours. And then I think the third thing is that personal factor of, like, you just get along with them. You can't quantify it, but you just get along with them. And so separate from any monetary gain, you're enjoying the time with them on the project. And isn't it fun to do the project with so-and-so? Because they make the day better and happier. So anyway, I think that's the best button we can put on that one, Jack. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
Dave, I got a great question that was sent to us from Comic Lab backer Stephen Barry, who says, "Hi, question answerers. Both of you have talked about how you like to write your comics on paper because of how you ideate. You both have long-form stories. Can you talk about your process to maintain and develop your long-term story points? Do you use computers for that kind of writing, or is it all notebooks?" So, Dave, let's talk process here. We both have long storylines with overarching stories that kind of crisscross back and forth. Yes. You're up to drive four at this point. Mm-hmm. How do you do it? How do you keep all that stuff straight? You got to have a computer involved at some point, right?
Yeah, so it's I will say, for me at least, it's an interesting dance of paper and digital. And what I mean by that is, usually when I'm writing that individual page, and I think Brad is the same way, so you can stop me if I'm speaking for you wrong. Usually I will write it on paper because there's all sorts of scratch outs, arrows, moving this block of text over here. And for all the reasons that everyone can imagine, there's an advantage to having the words scratched out, but it's still on the page. So that when I'm still looking at it 45 minutes from now, I go, what was that version that I had that they said, no, I shan't be going, instead of, no, it was something different. It was, oh, hey, look at the scratch out. What was the scratch out? No, I shall not be going. Yeah, that's the better way to write that. You know, whatever the phrase was.
Right.
You know, sometimes you get ahead of yourselves in your writing and you go, no, you know what? The first version was best. I'm going to go back to that. And so you can actually on a physical page, look at 7 scratch outs ago in a very helpful way. And I'm sure there is software that allows for that. I mean, maybe in a history, I guess, of edits, but that's shitty. It's more fun. Yeah. There's energy as a visual person. There's also energy on a page where I can see how energetically I wrote certain phrases. That meant the emphasis line, and there are arrows and energy buttons and stars and this and that I'm putting on there. And sometimes little sketches in there of like just a quick thumbnail of what this person's physicality is while they're saying that line. All that sort of stuff you can't capture in software. And so I do it in a analog pencil pen, the kind of way. But for long form stuff, certain ideas, I will email myself. This is a terrible way, by the way. I do not recommend it. It is just a pattern that I've fallen into over 20 years of cartooning, where if I have the germ of an idea, I will literally send myself an email that the subject heading is always idea. And that is the skeletonized version of a comic or a page that I want to do a couple months from now, or some storyline that I don't want to forget. Yeah. And so I have that sort of saved in Google All Mail that I can always refer to. And then the third one that I use is To-Do, is a program from Microsoft that is it used to be Wonderlist, but they got bought out. To-Do sort of allows you to categorize and then subcategorize all sorts of ideas and things you need to do and things you need to remember. And so I have some sort of very long-term story points captured. But then I will say one final thing before I pass it over to Brad. I can't emphasize enough how much stuff is just sort of floating in the back of my head that I know I'm going to get to, but it's not captured anywhere. And if I ever took a significant blow to the head, the future of Drive might be in trouble because some of the stuff is just purely recall. Like I know that when this happens in the story, I'm going to do this because I planned it 4 years ago. So now, Brad, how do you do it? Paper versus digital. How does your writing go, especially with long form?
First of all, I want to point out how brilliant it is, and you just mentioned it. Every time you do this digitally, you send an email to yourself, you do it with the same exact subject line, which is idea. And I wanted to say how smart that was, because then you can go in and search your previous emails, and all you got to do is put the word idea in, and you're going to get all of these. So if you can't remember something, or if you're trying to find something, you've got the subject line already, and it's always the same thing.
Always the
same
thing. Which
I think is very smart. I like that. Me, all paper, no software. I don't do any software.
Yeah.
I can't do it. First of all, there's a connection between writing with your hand and your brain. That's why they always tell you to take notes with a pencil or a pen, not to type notes.
Yeah.
Because there's a real intrinsic connection.
As far as like triggering
there.
A mnemonic in your brain when you're physically writing. Yeah, you're right.
And you can look down at something that you doodled or sketched or wrote, and you can remember the emotion behind that shape as it was coming out of your pencil. You know, there's a real connection there. It's why I always tell my students and my kids, take notes by hand. Don't sit there and type. It's a different thing. Make your hand move. So I do all my initial ideating in on paper. And for anything else, I just stay with paper. I've got post-it notes that point to certain places in old sketchbooks. Some things I will literally make a copy of a sketchbook page and tape it or even print it out on adhesive paper, like a stick, a big 8.5 by 11 sticker.
Yeah.
I'll print it out on that and then stick it into the next sketchbook and carry it over to the next sketchbook that way. I've got sketchbooks that have copies of previous sketchbook pages from 3 or 4 sketchbooks back, because it's still stuff I'm working on and still stuff that's hanging, or I got to remember to do this. And there's some things like I've got a copy of The Hero's Journey on a sheet. And I always that is a little bit software. I did that in Adobe InDesign. And I just, when I'm ready to start a new sketchbook, I just print that out, paste it into the new sketchbook on an early page. I've got that and the writing circle, just things to help me remember. Like when I'm starting a new chapter, I come back and I go, all right, because I always got to remind myself. And before I throw it back over to you, one more thing that is written in every sketchbook that I've had since I started to take a lot more serious stance towards writing. And that is just to remind myself, I've got it written. A story is a character with a want or a need who's facing an obstruction. That sentence is in every sketchbook going back 3 or 4, because I keep forgetting. And I keep getting stuck.
Yeah.
And when I realize I'm stuck, I go back to it and it's like, I got to focus on this.
Yeah.
So I've got a bunch of old pages that I just carry forward, but no software, none at all, because it slows me down.
That's funny, because it's funny you should mention that, because my mantra with Drive, because I always go back to it whenever I see it in a sketchbook, it's always optimism in the face of terrible circumstances. That's my mantra for Drive.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, because I always sort of I have to remind myself, don't forget to be funny in this shitty moment that they're in the story.
Yeah.
That these are friends trying to, with optimism, to overcome. Anyway, so I will relate a story about note-taking and writing that I think will be helpful, because we are all visual people. And it's funny the people that have impacted your life and given you permission to do something differently. So let me back up a little bit. When I was a student in school, I was a very good student, right? I got very good grades and I took very detailed notes, but they were always like, this is a note. Now I'm on the next line. Here is the next note. Oh, here is a little subparagraph. And this is why they did that in history, right? And it was very dink, 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 dink.
Like an outline. You'd have Roman numerals, then capital letters and numbers, then
lowercase letters. Everything was a bullet point, if that makes sense. Yep. Like everything was a boring ass bullet point, and it was a whole page of notes of bullet points, and it was unexciting. And so anyway, flash forward to me. I finished my master's degrees. I'm now working at Mattel Toys. And one of my buddies is the head, not the head, but he was one of the fashion designers for Barbie, like designed amazing looks for Barbie. And he was also an incredibly fun guy, and we got along great. And we were working together on some project. And I look over at his notes And I'm like, wait, Jesse, can I look at your notebook for a second? Because he and I were both taking notes on some lecturer. And he passes his notebook over to me. Brad, his notebook was alive with, like, not just arrows, but, like, artfully drawn arrows, curvatures, Googie-type signs from the 1950s, you know? And, like, but everything, every point was, like, certain notes were drawn in a script. Other notes were drawn in block letters. Other notes, you know what I mean? Like, but you looked at the page, and it was, like, a designed page. It wasn't note-taking. Yeah. It was, he was capturing the mood and the tone visually along with the information. And right. I was like, holy shit, Jesse, I've never taken notes like this. This is so fun. And also you're capturing what the mood is in this moment. And I relate this story only to say he gave me permission to change my boring ass notebooks to become exciting and interesting. And I shared these a long time ago on Comic Lab, Brad. Remember, very like in year one on Patreon, maybe I could dig them up, but.
It's back when we went to PatreCon, so I think you could probably use that as a keyword to find these if you want.
Yeah, because I remember you were sitting next to me, and you
I was
said,
fascinated.
What the hell are these notes that you're taking, right? Like, well, relate to me, relate to everyone what you saw in the notes that I was taking.
Oh, it was everything you said, but also, like there was things that jutted out, and then all of a sudden, there'd be an arrow that would sweep over and connect two thoughts when you realize that two things were connecting. There might be a little face down there that was just indicating like a mood or a stance of what that person was saying at the time. It was a completely visual way to take a note. And I mean, not only was it kind of beautiful, but you could tell that by glancing at that, even by letting your eyes drift across what was going on there, you were remembering a whole lot more than just the words or the points. You were remembering that moment as you're going through that note. And it was an amazing way to take notes. Super effective.
And the only reason I mention that is because in this discussion between writing on paper or writing digitally, there's something that paper gives us as visual people that is much more impactful. And again, I'm not taking credit for this. This is Jesse's idea, not mine, that we are visual thinkers and we don't have to stick to the boring bullet point way that we were taught in school of this is a note, this is a story note. Now I'm writing a story beat. Now you can capture the energy and the tone and the mood of a scene that you are writing with the way you are writing it on the page. And Microsoft Word can't capture that, but a notebook can capture that. And so when it comes down to the brass tacks of it, I think writing the page on a physical piece of paper is a much better way of doing it.
Absolutely. So, Dave, we've got another question from a $5 Patreon backer for patreon.com/comiclab. This one comes in from Dave Lerner, who says, neither of you have a broadcast standards and practices department or an editor telling you what you can or cannot do. How do you ensure that your safe for work comics are indeed safe? Do you have a list of what you allow or do not allow, or do you play it by ear? Have you ever gotten complaints or even gotten in trouble for going too far? Since Instagram, Webtoons, and other sites have their own policies, do you ever have difficulty following those policies? I really enjoy the show. Thanks for all you've shared with us. And Dave, before I let you answer that, I think it's connected to something that another Patreon backer, MJ Paxton, wrote. And I'm just going to throw this in because I think the two are kind of a dovetail nicely. Brad has mentioned that his views on sex, violence, and consent helped his decision to make Not Safe for Work comics. What are some other times that your personal ethics have shaped your artistic or professional decisions? And I think we're kind of talking about the same thing here, Dave. So I'll kind of give this a headline, but there's a lot of subtopics. I guess the headline here is, without an editor, how do you make content decisions?
Yeah, that's a great way to summarize it. Both of these are basically asking at the baseline of, if no one is there to tell you what to do, how do you know what to do? Where do you draw the line, or how far do you push it? Or where do you know, both on an ethical, moral, legal, a storytelling standpoint, where to stop a story, where, how far to take it, and that kind of thing. So this is a really good question. And so much of it comes down to personal artist integrity as an adult, which is basically taking responsibility for what you're writing And also mm-hmm. knowing what mood you're trying to create and also knowing what your audience is. And all three of those are in interplay. They're not like separated out. So let's talk. Let me talk about Sheldon, for example, as a way to start, because that's the opposite end of the spectrum from Brad's Evil Inc. After Dark. Right. So Sheldon is an all ages comic strip. It is meant to be enjoyed by young readers and old, and ideally together, you know, like that kind of thing. Some of the favorite photos that I get sent to me in email is when a parent is reading Sheldon with their kids. Like that is that's just icing on the cake. I love that. Right. That's fantastic. Yeah. And so the entire editorial slant of that comic is make it welcoming, make it warm, make it inviting, make it safe in terms of all sorts of ways that you could define the word safe. And basically have limits on it that would let an 8-year-old read it with an 80-year-old, that kind of thing. And within that, I can have a tremendous amount of fun. Like there's a sort of sweet goofiness to it that allows for all sorts of weird wackiness. And like we've said on this show in the past, it allows for I allow myself to do single panels that are not related to the comic. I allow myself to go wildly off topic. But broadly speaking, it's all within a rubric of keeping it safe for a certain age group. Now, Brad also on the opposite end of things with his not suitable for work thing has very clearly defined that, like, look, it's for adults. It's geared for adults. It's we all have an understanding that adults have active and interesting lives. But consent is really important and really key in this entire process. Right. So that's a different sort of limit on keeping it safe, you know.
And that's also, and that comes in down to another area here, and that is the problem with this is if you start to make bad decisions here, you're gonna get an immediate course correction handed to you one way or another. In other words, you're gonna start losing readers, right? Yeah. If you make poor decisions, like if Dave all of a sudden says I'm gonna drop an F-bomb in Sheldon, I just feel like it today, right? That might be delightful for that Tuesday that he posted. He might feel very good about himself, but he's going to turn off a lot of people who aren't going to come back, right? And Dave knows this as a professional. So he's got certain lines that he's drawn for himself. I guess my question for you, Dave, is do you have kind of a mental image of your audience that you keep in mind as you're writing? And do you visualize them reading and reacting to that?
Wow, what a good question. I don't think that I do.
It made me think of that.
I don't want this to sound egotistical and narcissistic, because when I'm doing it, it doesn't feel it. But I write it for me. If I make myself laugh, if I make myself enjoy the situation, then I know that I want to put the cartoon out into the world. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that feels different than a narcissistic creation. But it's basically, I don't know how to pretend that I'm a 9-year-old living in Des Moines. I'm just Dave Kellett in Los Angeles, and I'm middle-aged and that sort of, you know, so all I can do is write for me. But what's interesting is ultimately Brad and I have to face ourselves at the end of the day. And so Brad has to write and I have to write to what makes us comfortable, what makes us happy. And I think both of us, if we got down to brass tacks of what we do, why we do what we do, it's an attempt to make the world better. Don't you think, Brad? Yeah. If you were trying to define. So for me, that means never punching down or really trying not to. I've made mistakes in the past. One or two comics out of 4,000 in Sheldon where I was like, you know what? Damn it, David, you were punching down on that one and don't do that again, right? And so those are course corrections. You go, all right, I'm never doing that again. Because you're trying to... I mean, listen, my baseline philosophy for cartooning is just make somebody's life a little bit better for a few seconds. And I'm virtually certain that's what Brad's baseline philosophy is, too, is just bring a smile, make the world a little bit better. Let people know that they're not alone. Right. Like that's the baseline of what we're trying to do. So if you're making people uncomfortable, if you're making people feel unsafe, if you're making people feel attacked or anything like that, then I feel like you're doing your job wrong. And so, broadly speaking, that's sort of the ethical and moral rubric behind the individual choices I make, is make people feel loved, make people feel like the world is going to be okay, you know, make people feel like they're not alone. And if you take that as your broad guide, then individual editing choices kind of click into place. Don't you think, Brad?
Yeah, I think so. Now, another question that it was asked, or another part of this question was, since Instagram and Webtoons and other sites have their own policies, do you ever have difficulty following those policies? So a couple months ago at this point, I got one of my comics taken down from Webtoons because it had nudity. And I went and I looked and and this is the public facing comic, right? There's no nudity in Evil Inc. And I went, I looked at it and I put in, you know, you could file a counter complaint, I guess. And I said, there's no nudity here. And they wrote back and said, yeah, but I guess you could see too much of the posterior of one of the characters. And they said that was sexualized and that if I wanted to fix it, I could post it again. And for me, I took a look at the number of people I've got subscribed on Webtoons, and I said, nope, not going to do it. I don't. Webtoons does not deliver enough readers for me to change how I do my comic. Mm-hmm. So I'm just not posting on Webtoons anymore. It's a very easy decision to make. And that's a decision that if you get to that point, you've got to make it for yourself too. I'm probably different than the normal Webtoons creator in that I don't believe that there's a finite number of readers. And I don't believe that Webtoons is going to deliver me readers that I can't get elsewhere. Okay. Mm-hmm. So by shutting down on Webtoons, by the way, it's happened months ago. My Patreon is still the same. My business is still the same. Yeah, it brings us into another conversation of passive readers versus active readers. Were those subscribers on Webtoons active readers? Good question. Doesn't seem to be. I think there's an infinite number of readers. Mm-hmm. And if I stop, if I'm going to have to jump through hoops on Webtoons, they've got to show me that they're bringing me enough readers to make it worth my time. I didn't believe that was the case. And I believe there's an infinite number of readers. So if I'm not going to find my readers on Webtoons, I'm going to find them someplace else. How do you deal with these? I can't imagine you're getting any takedown notices, but at what point do you draw a line on doing what a social media platform requires of you, for example?
Well, I think we can all, and I'm not saying this in any sort of way to get a joke, I think we can all agree that I'm more Pollyanna-ish than Brad is in my cartooning. Like, I'm much more like, oh, I would never, I couldn't imagine drawing that sort of thing. we're just different people, and that's perfectly fine. So I don't come up across editorial limitations, I would say, both in terms of language or visuals or that sort of thing. I think if and when I ever would be limited, because I'm just trying to take a look at the body of my work, Sheldon very often makes pop culture jokes, pop culture references. So I could see a world where Sheldon ran up against copyright takedowns because, I don't know, I made fun of Doctor Strange and Disney could say, hey, we'd like to put a takedown notice on that Doctor Strange comic. So and just for a quick overview, a copyright law allows for commentary on copyrighted works. Mm-hmm. It's part of the sort of freedom of speech allowed in copyright. But you cannot use a copyrighted work to comment on something else. That's where it gets a little bit tricky, right? So you can't use Pop-Tarts to make fun of Ford Motor Company, right? If you're going to make fun of Ford Motor Company, you've got to use those copyrights. You get where I'm going with this. Anyway, I don't know why I picked Pop-Tarts. What a weird thing to pick.
Now I'm hungry.
So anyway, what I'm saying is, if I ever run up against limitations, it might be my gentle skirting of copyright law in terms of the way I make fun of certain titles and projects and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't know if you've noticed this, but somewhere in the back of your studio, it's like a school class just got left out because there's like 40 kids either running around behind you in Philadelphia. I don't know what's going on behind you. But
I was wondering whether you could hear. That's why I kept taking my earphone out. No. So, there's a this studio backs right up onto a residential block, and the people that live right on the other side of that window put a above ground pool up.
And so on a hot day in Philadelphia, suddenly you're like, So
yep,
here's what our summer of podcasting is. Here's what our summer of podcasting is going to look like. I will be sweating it out in my podcasting closet, and then you'll be hearing kids going to town in the pool next door. That's amazing. Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. They're having a good time. Now, here's one more question I wanted to ask you, because this is a little bit more universal. Have you ever gotten a complaint that you went too far from a reader, and then what do you do?
I have. I probably get it less than the average cartoonist because, again, I'm pretty Pollyanna-ish. I don't know. But when I do get a complaint, it's usually from like, hey, I don't think you realized it, but this is kind of that word choice or that phrasing or the angle of the way you said that could be read as a little bit demeaning to XYZ group or to this or that, right? And that, having done 4,000 or so Sheldons, that's probably happened, I don't know, a half dozen times. And usually I will be honest that I pause, I think about it, I consider it about like, am I punching down or am I accidentally taking a swing at a group that I don't mean or even, you know, considered having taken a swing at, but I accidentally did it. And of the times that people have reached out, maybe half the time I altered the text or I've changed it a little ways. And the other times I'm like, no, I genuinely think that this person is being oddly sensitive to something that I'm not at all saying in this. And so I'll leave it as is. Have you ever had anything like that, Brad?
It's happening right now.
Oh, really?
It does not happen often. It really doesn't. But I had a joke where I needed this to move certain plot points to where they needed to be. But I had a rare death in Evil Inc. It was almost a nameless character. It was somebody that it just existed for that one panel. Mm-hmm. But he had to be taken out to open up a space in Commander Heroic's hospital room, right? So, it was all, again, wordplay, going back to Asterix. There's a supervillain that's pretending to be a doctor. And so he was attending when this superhero gets offed in the hospital. And the nurse comes up and says, what happened to that patient? And he says, oh, he took a turn from the worse. And then in the next panel, he has brought in a tornado hero and kind of tricked him into using his tornado powers on the hapless hero that got killed. And he's being turned around and around and around and around. And so the joke is he took a turn for the worse, or about 6,572 of them. Right. And then she says, That's too bad. I thought you'd be able to stabilize him. They take him out on a stretcher with the sheet over him. And he says, well, in my defense, he's very stable now. Okay. So that was the whole joke. And he said, there's never been this is a malicious, this is a death in Evil Inc. And it was done very callous. He didn't like the joke. and he's very upset about it. And he's a Patreon backer, and he's talking about this in the Patreon comments to this comic.
And was the specific critique the word stable? Was that what the problem was?
No, it was the fact that it was the death. It was the death of this character the fact that I killed the character that by the way, again, didn't exist before this panel. In other words, he wasn't an existing character.
Oh, I see.
It's just kind of like a nameless, faceless death.
Yeah, you basically trotted him on stage in order to kill him, in order to trot him right back off the stage. Yeah.
Exactly.
So this reader's, I want to try to crystallize. So this reader's complaint was that there was any death at all in Evil Inc.
Right.
Is that right? So up until this point, this reader's contention was that it was sort of like those old G.I. Joe cartoons where if a plane got shot down, you always saw a parachute, right? You never saw anybody die in G.I. Joe because of TV standards. So their concern was that this comic always had a certain levity because no one actually died, but you have actually killed someone now, and that changes the tone of the comic. Okay, so how was your reaction out of this?
I've been holding back. To be honest, I want to let him express himself. He's got perfectly valid thoughts, But I want to, and so far I've been letting the other readers kind of take the other side, because there has been pushback from other people.
Okay.
And they have said, well, you know, it is Evil Inc. These are super villains. They are bad guys. They do bad things. And, you know, his counter is, yeah, but it's never ended in a death before. I've been holding back myself because I want to give him a chance to express. But if at the point which I get involved, I'm going to have to be honest and say, I'm not going to change how I think that was a good joke. I think it was a good story beat. Right. I'm not going to change how I do it. I'm not going to change how I did it. And I'm not going to change how I do the next one. Me getting involved is going to just end up with this person feeling even more upset. So right now I'm just letting him vent and seeing if it's something he really demands an answer for, then I'll get involved. Otherwise I'll let him vent and leave it at that.
Well, I will say this about this specific case and a lot of other cases where you and I have faced a complaint. And I think this relates to the question asker. Again and again and again, as a creator, I have realized that the complaint often says as much about that person in that moment of their life as it does about whatever it was that I wrote. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I guess what I'm saying is sometimes I'll do a joke that's totally innocuous and innocent, and they'll come at it and they'll put a lot of sauce on it that wasn't there. And I was like, I can just tell as a sympathetic human listening to the email of another human, like, look, there's clearly something going on in your life and I'm not going to poke this with a stick. I just wish you a good day. And I don't know what it was that I triggered for you in terms of a bad event in your life, but this was neither the intent nor was it the generally received communication the way that you were reading this. And so I think that I will just quietly let this go because you are clearly suffering in a moment right now, you know, and it could be someone's in a bad moment. There's a death in their family. Someone's just getting out of a bad relationship. Someone is starting a new stage in their life and they're afraid. You can imagine 1,000 situations where Brad and I have gotten emails where someone's basically in a bad place. And whatever it was that you wrote, some word choice, some event in your comic, it triggered for them. And all you can do is say, I'm sorry, this is neither the intended nor is it the generally read reaction to this comic. But I am, for what it's worth, I am sorry that this created this mood for you. My intent is to create joy in people's hearts. And I'm sorry that I did not do that for you today. And sometimes, Brad, we've talked about this before, actually, before we move on, I will get an email like 2 years later that says, and I never prompted it. I'll get an email 2 years later and be like, hey, I just stumbled across this old email that I sent you and I was in a really dark place and you didn't know this at the time, but this and this and this was happening. So now 20 years into my cartooning, I've seen this pattern happen more than a few times. It's been at least a handful of times that I've gotten this, a follow-up email years later. Like, hey, I had just dropped out of college and I was having some trouble and, you know, this and that. And you're like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. I wasn't mad at the time, but I'm grateful now that this is a lovely email. And thank you for that.
Yep. And to be honest with you, that's why I'm hanging back a little bit, because the only thing in my mind that this could be is that this person's had a death in the family and that this is hitting.
That's what my immediate thought really was, like, sharp. In this time of death, something has triggered them. So, they've had a loss or something, you know, or frankly, even if they haven't had a loss, can't you just imagine a certain personality for which they look at, I don't know, 500,000 Americans dead. And they're like, it's just too much death right now. I don't want a storyline about death, you know? So I could see that kind of person too. And all you can say is, I'm sorry that I was attempting levity and I've created the opposite for you. And I apologize about that, you know?
Absolutely. And that's why I'm kind of, I don't want to antagonize this person any further. And so it's a tough balance to maintain. You know, at certain points, one of the things that made us as web cartoonists different is reaching out and having a direct connection to our readers. Right. And at the same time, you also have to realize that that's something that you can also use to make somebody feel even worse. You know?
Yeah, and that's why I say, even though there are moments where I, in my heart of hearts, disagree with whatever criticism they might be sending my way, the way I can always say it, and I advise others to use it too, because I think it's heartfelt and true, is, look, my goal with my comics is to bring you joy, and I'm sorry that I didn't do that for you today. That way, I'm not specifically saying I was wrong in this motion, because in this moment, because I don't think I was in that writing moment, nor do I think that you were in that writing moment about death. Clearly, human to human, you have triggered something for them that is in echoing their own life in a painful way. And so all you can say as a cartoonist is, hey, my goal with Evil Inc. is to bring you joy, and I'm sorry that today's didn't bring you joy. And that's sincere, you know, and both in terms of not changing what you wrote, but also saying, look, I'm sorry that human to human, I didn't do it for you today, and we're going to try again tomorrow.
Absolutely. But one thing I do have to say, Dave, is that you once again brought me joy here this Tuesday morning on another episode of Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Well, your hosts have been my friend Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my friend Dave Kellett, co-director of the comics documentary Stripped and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And I will remind everyone with a huge thanks in advance, head over to drivekickstarter.com and check out the video and check out the books. You can get both Act 3 of Drive or Acts 1 through 3. I am incredibly proud of that story. I heartily encourage you to check it out. And I will say the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. You may hear your review featured on a future episode. And if you join us at the $10 level at patreon.com/comiclab, you can join us for these weekly recording sessions. You've got your VIP access. You can watch us recording the show.
It is like VIP access. You're right. It is VIP access. This is like the back room. You've got, what is that, bottle service? You're at a club where someone brings you a $1,000 bottle of something stupid? All right. Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/comiclab. That's one small step for man, one giant... Oh, dear God, what is that? It's a T-Rex skull. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like, imagine you're the first people on the moon. You're coming down the little gangplank, and there's a Stegosaurus skeleton over to the side there.
Or, I mean, what if it's just a tooth, and it's still sharp enough to puncture your astronaut suit? Could you imagine? It would be the longest... A Rube Goldberg in history that ended in your death.
Oh my God. It is the ultimate Rube Goldberg. all it required was an interstellar asteroid coming in faster than a speeding bullet to do that Rube Goldberg device. Yeah.
A couple of million years. It finally pulls the trigger.
Just imagine, like, all of human endeavors in the 20th century, you know, going from the Wright brothers to eventually creating the Saturn V rocket. You get to the moon, you're coming down the gangplank, your chute gets punctured by a dang ankylosaurus's tooth. You're like, God damn it, what are the odds of this?